From the BBC in London, this is Brian Matthew introducing The Beatles Story, a 20th century fairy tale in 13 parts. Like all good fairy tales, our story starts way back in the mists of time, when the people all had short hair, went to church on Sundays, and would never dream of talking about drugs or sex. In those mists of time, there floated across the water from America sounds like Frankie Lane.
If ever the devil was born without a pair of horns, it was you. Chance of hell, it was you.
Johnny Ray.
If your sweetheart sends a letter of goodbye, it's no secret you feel better if you cry.
And Bill Haley.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock, we're gonna rock around the clock tonight.
And the vocal sounds of a magic giant, Elvis Presley. And in England, we had Lonnie Donegan. All these sounds were heard in the northern seaport of Liverpool, where children sometimes went to school, like most other children, but sometimes they stayed at home, and with cheap guitars and T-chess basses, tried to make these sounds themselves. From these many influences emerged the individual sound of the greatest pop group of our time, the Beatles.
Should I?
This is the story of that Beatle music and the four people who made it. Part one, the birth of the Liverpool sound. John Lennon, born on October the 9th, 1940. His parents separated when he was quite young and he was brought up by his aunt. He went through the usual education course from primary school to Quarry Bank High School. But his mother still had quite an influence.
My mother played banjo, so, and I remember my granddad playing it when I was very young. Yeah? And she often played it if there was anything round, but there was never one round, you know, they'd all sold them in the hard times. And then I convinced her to buy me a guaranteed not to split guitar, you know, for £10, send away, and she got it me, and she taught me banjo chords. So on very early photos of the group, you see I'm playing funny chords on the guitar.
This guitar playing wasn't taken seriously by anyone.
It's a joke in the family now, you know, the guitar's all right for a hobby, that's the big thing, it's quite, but it won't earn you any money. I know that I was thinking that I should have, you know, I was obviously musical from very early, and I just wonder why nobody ever did anything about it. Because maybe because they couldn't afford it.
The lack of musical training didn't stop him getting together with some school friends to form the Quarrymen Skiffle Group. In the summer of 1955, another young musician joined up with John and his group. His name, Paul McCartney. Paul was born on the 18th of June, 1942, and from his primary school went on to the Liverpool Institute. His father plays piano, and Paul, oddly enough, started out on trumpet, but graduated to guitar later. He found a few problems with this, as he's naturally left-handed, but he soon mastered the instrument and became a competent vocalist, too.
He used to be sort of influenced by Elvis in the old days, I think. Just love him. Chuck Berry, yeah. Carl Perkins. Mm. And Marvin Gaye and things. Can't really sing like him, you know. Him, though.
Among Paul's school friends was a younger musician who was reckoned to be one of the better guitarists in the area, George Harrison. George was born on the 25th of February, 1943, and he too went to the Liverpool Institute.
At school, I was a very bad pupil. In fact, I was, you know, probably one of the worst pupils they've ever had in the school. Yeah. But, you know, I realise that now. At the time, you know, I was all for having a good laugh, and if this hadn't have worked, then I don't really know what I would have been doing. Because I left school, I was an electrician for about, or apprentice electrician for about 4 months. And I decided, I remember asking my big brother, you know, would you pack in work and have a go at this if you were me? And he said, well, you know, you might as well, you never know. And he said, if you don't, you're not going to lose anything by, you know, just working in that job.
Was there anything at school that you liked?
The only thing I liked, really, was art. Mm. And I realised now that it was because the teacher at art was a nice fella, and he'd come round and try and, you know, he'd say, no, why don't you do it this way? And the others, you know, if you'd go up and say, well, I a bit doubt, and they shout at you and, or give you a belt in the gob, you know, which didn't really help. Anyway, after school and this job, which only lasted a bit, I joined full-time. Well, the others, Paul and John were still, John was at art college and Paul was doing an extra year at school. So by the time I'd been at this place for 4 or 5 months, and they were just due out of school, and then we got the opportunity to go to Scotland and then on to Hamburg, and then after that I just forgot all about, you know, 9 till 5.
More of Scotland and Hamburg later. But back in 1958, the Quarrymen disbanded, and these three members continued under the new name of Johnny and the Moondogs. Their sound? Well, it wasn't exactly distinctive at that stage.
Oh, Dirty Maggie May. George, she guilty found it, but I'm in the home of found it. That dirty, no good Robin Maggie May.
So this was the basis of the world's greatest group, hardly a distinguished start. They changed their name again, this time to the Silver Beatles, and although they had no steady drummer, one more member did start appearing on a regular basis, Stu Sutcliffe. Stu was at art college with John, and as a promising artist had won a prize of £60. With this, he bought a bass guitar and joined up. They entered one or two talent contests without much luck, but at least they were playing regularly at coffee bars and clubs around Liverpool. What did they sing? Well, here's the earliest recording we could find of your actual Silver Beatles. First, a very recognisable John and Lucille. Following on that spirited rendition of Lucille by John, here's Paul in country mood with one called I Forgot to Remember.
I forgot to remember to forget her. I can't seem to get her out my mind. Never miss her, but I found out somehow. I think about her almost all the time. Well, the day she went away, I made myself a promise that I'd soon forget we ever met.
I forgot to remember. The early Beatles. Of course, they weren't the only group in Liverpool. There were hundreds. This was the year when Princess Margaret married Tony Armstrong Jones and Senator John F. Kennedy was elected President of the United States. The boys were perhaps more concerned over local events, including their regular appearances at the coffee bar The Jacaranda. The owner was Alan Williams, who'd used Stu Sutcliffe to organise the floats for the Liverpool Arts Ball.
Well, he approached me, he says, why don't you do something for us, Alan? I said, well, how do you mean, who's us? You know, he said, well, John and Paul, we've got a group, which we call the Beatles. So he told me the lineup of the group, and they hadn't got a drummer. I said, well, who's drums? He said, we haven't got a drummer. I said, well, you've got to have a drummer. Anyway, I said, I'll try and fix you up with a drummer. And so there sort of started me off with the Beatles. And I got them local gigs for 10 bob a man and things like that. But they were so enthusiastic, which is missing now in groups. You know, those days the groups would work, say, from 9 o'clock at night, maybe till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, because they loved the music. And this is, I reckon, was the making of them.
Alan later went to Hamburg with some of the tapes of the Silver Beatles and other groups to try and get them work over there.
I told them that the groups were the best in England and that they were very famous groups and you could have them with tongue in cheek in those days because the Beatles used to be working for 5 bob a night and 10 bob a night. I said, it'll cost you £100 a week plus my commission of £10.
The club owner he met was Bruno Koschmider. He subsequently came to England and met Alan Williams in the Two Eyes Coffee Bar in London.
Das war 1959-60. Wir hatten hier in Hamburg mein ganz Lokal, das war ja ein Jugend.
The first group who Mr. Koschmider saw was a group around Tony Sheridan. And he quite liked him and he told this manager that this is the type of group he was looking for.
The Beatles at that time were unavailable, but Alan Williams arranged for Tony Sheridan and another group he managed, Derry and the Seniors, to go to Koschmieder's club in Hamburg, where they were a big hit. British Beat was proving to be good for business, and a few weeks later, Bruno Koschmieder was on the phone to Alan Williams with an offer of work for another group.
So I approached the Beatles and asked them would they do it. And they said, yeah, we'd love to do it, but we haven't got a drummer. The drummer which they had, which was Tommy Moore, I'd packed in. And the way he packed in was quite funny, actually. I'd got him booked in at this Grosvenor Ballroom over in Wallasey. And one night, they were booked over there, and the phone went, and it was Stuart. Stuart was the spokesman. And he said, look, Alan, he says, Tommy Moore hasn't turned up. We're still stuck in the Jacaranda. So I whizzed down, picked him up, and we went round to his house. We knocked on the door, and Tommy Moore's wife was in the bedroom. She shouted, what do you want? I said, where's Tommy? He's supposed to be playing. You can go and piss off, because he's not playing any more with you. We've had enough, you know. And he's got a job in Garston Bottle Works, you know, on the night shift. So we drove to Garston Bottle Works, and out came poor Tommy in his overalls. I said, well, you know, what are you doing, Tommy? And he said, well, look, the missus won't have it, he says. So I said, oh, well, I understand, you know. So I said, well, you'd have to do without a drummer, you know. Now, they'd sometimes played at this club in Haymans Green, which was owned by a Mrs. Best. And she had a son who was, you know, who was a drummer. And he sat in with the Beatles occasionally when they played there. And they said, Alan, we've got a drummer. So we got a drummer now. And the lineup was George Harrison, Paul McCartney, John Lennon, Stuart Sutcliffe, and the new arrival, Pete Best.
So the group's complete, the date is set, and Alan, his wife, an interpreter, assorted friends, and the five Beatles set off all in one car for Europe. On arrival in Hamburg, they opened at the Indra nightclub.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, we'd like to sing Twist and Shout. You know you look so good. You know you
There were soon problems with the neighbours over the volume of their music, which led to their removal from the Indra to the Kaiserkeller. Bruno Koschmider again.
The next time the police came, they played very low and played waltz for one hour, so all the young people left. Well, this scene in the other club, Indra, with the Beatles, went on for a while, and then Mr. Koschmider had to close it down, and he says he thinks he lost about 100,000 marks on the Beatles because they were so loud, but he had a contract with them, and at that time nobody knew anything about the music, so nobody put anything about the volume into the contracts, so he couldn't do anything. After Tony Sheridan's time was over in the Kaiserkeller, Rory Storm and his group came, and because he still had the Beatles under contract, he put them on as the second group. So they played hour after hour, you know.
The drummer with Rory Storm was none other than Ringo Starr. It was here that they first worked together.
Rory Storm was more popular than the Beatles, so his impression was that they tried to impress the audience more, you know. And he says they behaved very bad. They called the audience Nazi Schweine and things like that. You know, they tried everything to be different. And he thinks most people didn't understand that at that time, what the Beatles were saying to them. But his club manager used to write all the insults down in a big book and told him the next day what they had been doing.
Well, this behavior didn't endear them to Herr Koschmider, but they were building up a strong following amongst the student population. Particular fans at this time were Klaus Voormann and Astrid Kirchherr, a keen photographer who was later to become a closer acquaintance of the boys. They too were realizing their popularity, and so they approached Peter Eckhorn, the manager of a larger club, the Top Ten, for possible work before a bigger audience and with the chance of more money. Before they actually started, though, more problems arose. George was found by the police to be under 18 and was sent home. And when the other four tried to start on their own, there was more trouble with the police, over a fire that had started in their former lodgings. Eventually, by Christmas 1960, most of them had arrived back at Liverpool, broke. Ted Nibbs, one of the early group managers.
The Beatles really came on the scene when a chap named Brian Kelly, who promoted jazz shows, and he wanted a group for a Boxing Day show. Bob Waller rang him up and said, "Hey Brian, I've got a group for you for tomorrow." He said, "Who are they?" He said, "Well, they call themselves the Silver Beatles." And he said, "Oh," he said, "are they good?" He said, "Yes," he said, "they're fantastic." Brian said, "Oh, how much do they want?" Bob said, "They want £8. And Brian Kelly said, "Not Pygmalion likely. I'm not paying any group £8. Really, I'd have a lot of arguing. He said, "Well, I'll take your word, and as soon as it's tomorrow night, I'll give them six."
Bob Wooler, the compere of the concert.
There it was. There was the scene. There was this expectant crowd. It was a sort of Christmas crowd. They'd all been clamoured to the stage because something very special was going to happen for them. And the curtains were closed. We primed each other as to exactly what we were going to do. And I announced, here they were, direct from Hamburg, the sensational Beatles. As the curtains swept open, Paul launched himself into one tall salad.
Soon after this date, Bob Wooler met up with Ray McFall, the owner of a jazz cellar, The Cavern, and as a result of that meeting, Bob moved in as compere of the lunchtime beat sessions. Bob, of course, was quick to promote his friends.
A month went by, and eventually they were accepted as an appearance. Well, I was to be castigated by Ray, because Ray had a very, you know, strong feeling about admitting people in jeans, because jeans had been identified with the teddy boys in trouble. And he didn't really approve of people going into the club with jeans on. And here were the Beatles playing on stage to his audience in jeans. And he developed a bit of a moody over that. But anyway, he was able to adjust. He was a very flexibly minded person, and he was to accept their slight differences to the convention.
From these lunchtime sessions, their popularity grew. Their name had changed to simply The Beatles by now, and they started doing evening sessions too. In April 1961 came more news from the Top Ten Club in Germany.
My name is Peter Eckhorn. They wrote a letter to me asking if they could play in the Top Ten in the future. And it was arranged that they play here April 61, and they played for 3 months.
Their contract with Peter Eckhorn said that they were to play every night from 7 until 2 in the morning, except Saturdays, when they would play till 3. And mostly they were backing their acquaintance of the previous trip, Tony Sheridan. Photographers started to take notice, and Stu Sutcliffe's romance with Astrid grew. She persuaded him to drop his greasy Teddy Boy haircut in favour of a more adventurous style, with the hair well-washed, cut differently, and brushed forward. Now, the others were sceptical at first, but eventually, with the exception of Pete Best, they all adopted it, and the famous haircuts were born. The colourless suits were adopted about the same time. So, the pattern of life for the next few months was set. Sleep during the day, and work for most of the night, building a fan following. If you happen to think it was a glamorous life in Hamburg in those days, listen to the singer the Beatles were backing, Tony Sheridan.
The circumstances we lived in, you know, the attic we lived in, the top ten, it was atrocious. Four flights up, Eckelman gets some army beds in, you know, tears beds. And a bucket to wash in, and no window and all that, you know. It's really drastic. And there was this old woman that lived next door. And she was paid by Peter Eckhorn to provide us with a fresh bucket of water every day. And Lennon used to really take it out of this old girl. My hobby in those days was collecting old souvenirs from the Nazi time. Armbands and flags and badges and Iron Cross medals, a whole lot. And we stuck all this stuff, everybody put something on. Lennon had big swastikas all over and an armband. And we're playing away on stage. We didn't really know then that it was against the law for a start, you know, and people were a bit peeved, so that was the end of that. The Germans used to like to see a visual performance. They couldn't believe us. For them, we were complete nutcases, thought we were all putty, because we'd leap about the stage and into the audience and all sorts of crazy things and chuck beer all over the place, generally misbehave ourselves. And they got used to this bit of show every night, and they came to expect it, you know. Some period during the night, they'd say, Machschau, Machschau, and depending on his mood, Lennon or somebody would either start stomping the stage to pieces,
Or Maxwell, you too, Maxwell, you know. Well,
of course, looking back, it seems inevitable that the talent would be discovered. The man who was one of the first to spot it, Alfred Schacht.
My name is Alfred Schacht, and at that time I was the German managing director of the Aberbach organization and was the European director of coordination. Now, one day I was in the Top Ten Club, and there were the Beatles, and they were the backing group of Tony Sheridan at that time. And I came mainly into the Top Ten Club because we worked with Tony Sheridan. And then I heard this group, and I think the day, next day or a few days later, I was together with Bert Kempfert. And I said to Bert Kempfert, listen, I have heard a group in Top Ten Club, which I think is a very good one and an outstanding one, and we should take care of this group somehow. And so we agreed that they next day should come into my office, next day at 11 o'clock, come into my office. So we discussed the recording contract, and they said yes, and there wasn't very much discussion, really. They were very happy to have a recording contract, and they were very happy to have a publishing contract, and that was it. And so the first song, I think the first song ever published of the George Harrison and John Lennon, was an instrumental, Cry for a Shadow.
Once the music was published, it was more or less inevitable that they should get together with Bert Kempfert and Tony Sheridan to make some records.
Bert Kempfert thought it was a bit of a laugh. He thought he'd have a go at trying to record a few things and asked us to go down the studio one morning at 8 o'clock. But Bert Kempfert didn't have any idea what he wanted us to play. So he said, what have you got that would appeal to the German public? And we'd just been doing this thing called My Bonnie that had been requested by a group of seamen or something, you know. All the kids learn at the school, they, you know, it's no-no here. So we rocked that up a bit.
My bonnie lies over the ocean. My bonnie lies over the sea. Well, my bonnie lies over the ocean. Yeah, bring back my bonnie to me.
On this session was Paul on bass, George and John on guitars, George electric, and myself on guitar and vocals. And Stuart Sutcliffe had already left then, but he was present as a friend, as an observer or something. And Pete Best on drums, of course. Oh, yeah, we can't forget Pete Best on drums. And The result of the session were a few little ditties, the best known of which, I suppose, is My Bonnie, and an old song by somebody called Ain't She Sweet that John sang. And they did a remix on this about 3 years later. It was number one in Australia because I went there on the strength of it, because I was on the other side.
Oh, ain't she sweet? I see you walking down that street. Yes, I ask you very confidentially, ain't she sweet? Oh, ain't she nice? Well, look her over once or twice. Yes, I ask you very confidentially, ain't she nice? Just cast an eye in her direction. Oh, me, oh, my, ain't that perfection? Oh, I repeat, well, don't you think that's kind of neat? Yes, I ask you very confidentially, ain't she sweet? Walking down that street, yeah, I ask you very confidentially, ain't she sweet? Well, I ask you very confidentially, ain't she sweet?
Yes, as Tony Sheridan said earlier, Stu Sutcliffe had left the group. He was always a talented artist, and his love for art and for Astrid made him decide to stay on in Hamburg, where he intended to get married and study at art college. As a result, Paul moved over to the vacated bass guitar, and the group was now reduced to four people. And what happened to those four people when they got back to England in July 1961, you can hear in the next edition of The Beatles Story. The Beatles Story was written and produced for the BBC by Johnny Veerling.